Just testing the microphone here.
Recording in progress.
Welcome, everybody. I'm going to give it 1 minute just to let the numbers settle out. We have a number of people transitioning from the SEC meeting, which has been going on for the last hour, and then, of course, other members of the faculty joining us on their own.
I got a call right after sex, so I did not.
Yeah.
Stand up.
There's not enough time between Zoom meetings ever.
It was a good meeting, the SEC meeting.
Okay, well, I think we can go. I'm just watching the little number thing tick here. You can get obsessed on these numbers. So I'm going to go ahead and get started because I have a little bit of a preamble before I turn it over to Anita Allen. But of course, we are very honored today to have Professor Anita Allen join us. She is the Henry R. Silverman Professor of Law and Professor of Philosophy, and of course, a former Vice Provost of the faculty. So brings a unique perspective or a body of knowledge to this, to these questions that we could all benefit from. So I just have a few things to say first, because obviously this is a both an important and a timely topic, but I also want to be clear and reiterate what I said at our last meeting, which is, the Senate has a formal role in relationship to sanctions brought against a standing faculty member. We administer the process, the process which is colloquially called a just cause proceeding. That process is very clearly defined in the handbook. It's organized to protect the interests of all the people, of all all the parties involved, and is a wholly confidential process. So in our role, in our role as tri-chairs, we cannot and will not comment on any active cases or anything going on. And I should add, in our formal roles, we actually don't even have any knowledge about the proceedings. I mean, once it starts, it's confidential to us as well. But I just want to be clear that this is our role and our responsibility. But that said, before any of the controversy that came up around Professor Amy Wax, the Senate had a session in December that all the SEC members here would have attended. This is a topic which is entering into our discourse from many, many different angles. We felt that it was an important topic for the Senate to take up all year. And so today's seminar is really offered as a continuation of that discussion. It seemed especially important to us because proceedings are confidential and people may, we or the community at large may never even know the results of some of those processes. Because of that, it seemed especially important for us to have an open conversation, a discussion among members of the faculty about these issues. The final thing I'll say is the inspiration for this came because we heard Professor Allen make a presentation to one of the Senate committees, essentially reviewing what's in the handbook, talking about, reflecting on and talking about some of the rules and protocols that have emerged over time. It was so insightful that we asked her to give that same talk more or less to the Senate so we could continue to explore the nature of academic freedom and responsibility. as I said, she's thought deeply about the rights, responsibilities, and limits to academic freedom. But I will also remind you that we will follow up next month, following the SEC meeting next month, in a session which we will also open to the standing faculty. We're going to do a follow-on seminar with Professor Ben Poroth and Michael Deli Carpini, following on the meeting we had in December, but this time again, allowing more opportunity for SEC members, well, members of the faculty, to ask questions and to discuss these things openly. So again, I want to make clear that we see this as one of the central topics of our moment for faculty to consider, and so we're extremely grateful that Professor Allen can take the time. And last organizational note before I turn it over to Professor Allen, I'm going to suggest that as we did in the SEC meeting, I'm going to suggest that if you have questions, and there would be lots of time for questions, please post them in the chat, and then I will call on individuals to pose their questions in their own words. So you can post them during the talk, but we'll get to them at the end after the presentation is concluded. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Professor Allen.
Thank you very much for asking me to come and have a discussion with the Senate Executive Committee about these very important issues. I'm really honored. As I look around the room, I see old friends and colleagues that I worked with in my 7 years as vice provost. I see vet, I see medicine, I see nursing, I see law, I see education, I see so many schools represented, social policy and practice. I'm honored that so many of you have come to engage with me about these important issues. So the first thing I want to say is that Penn has a shared governance model for faculty governance. And what that means is that we ourselves as the faculty participate in and share the responsibility for governing the faculty. It's not just that the provost and the president or the trustees, it's that we ourselves have an important, incredibly important role. And that's why the very hard issues that come up with respect to faculty affairs and the hardest questions and problems that come up need to be things that we feel educated about and comfortable talking about with one another. The fact that they're difficult and awkward doesn't mean we shouldn't have the conversations. So the things I want to focus on today are two, and they do relate to one another. I want to talk about respecting academic freedom, which is so important, along with diversity, equity, and inclusion, also very important. And I want to talk about the matter of when a tenure-track position is deservedly taken away. On the screen, you see some photographs of people who've been affected, rightly or wrongly, by tenure removals or denials. You have Angela Davis. You have a faculty member who pretended to be Black. You have a faculty member who made comments deemed anti-Semitic. You have a faculty member who was part of a controversial slavery research project, controversial with conservatives. And you have a professor who was accused of sexual harassment. So we're going to be talking about a range of different kinds of reasons why someone's tenure might be placed on the line. Not these people in particular, but I just wanted to give you some examples. These are real things. Everybody faces it. Women, men, people of color, white people, everybody can be faced with situations in which their job is on the line. Quick facts. As you know, we have a very large, diverse, and eminent faculty. What some faculty don't know is how many of us there are. We have over 7,000 full and part-time professionals on several tracks, including the tenure track, but also the CE track, the academic clinician track, and the practice professor track. So there are a lot of people on Penn who have the faculty label. The largest school by number of faculty, of course, is a medical school. More than half the faculty is in the medical school. The next largest schools are SAS, Wharton, and C's. It's important to keep in mind as we have this discussion as a community that a minority of Penn faculty are tenured or on the tenure track. Tenure is not the typical relationship that a Penn faculty member has with the university, but some of us do have that relationship. And so many of the issues we're talking about today really bear primarily on the question of when can those people, that minority of us who have tenure, face loss of our employment, and when do our rights as a tenured faculty member to engage in freedom of speech clash in ways which are hard to balance or to reconcile with values around diversity, inclusion, and equity. Our faculty is diverse. It's gotten more diverse. So about 35% of us are women now, and about 25% of us are minority, including Asians, 4% Black, 4% Hispanic, the best Asian and mixed race. So we are a very diverse faculty. And so it matters, right, how we shape our community, given that we come from such different backgrounds. So we are governed and protected by documented principles, rules, and policies. I do think sometimes there may be an impression that the standards of behavior to which we're held are sort of an unwritten common law, which is not exactly the way it works at Penn. We have we do have a voluntary subscription to First Amendment ideals of toleration and free speech. Penn is not bound by the Constitution, but we choose to follow it. And there are documents that express this commitment to toleration and free speech. Penn defines itself as an open expression campus, and there's a written open expression policy. Penn defines itself as committed to equal opportunity, equity, inclusion, and diversity. And Penn has many documents, including many faculty diversity reports and inclusion reports, that express these values coming from the highest levels of the university. Penn voluntarily embraces AAUP academic freedom and tenure principles. And so Penn faculty are bound by documented principles, rules, and policies, like no sex with undergraduates, and you can't hold a tenure track job someplace else and also have a tenure track job at Penn. And you have to disclose certain conflicts of interest and disclose conflicts of equity. These are rules and policies and principles which govern our lives, and they're pretty, for the most part, uncontroversial. The faculty handbook which is actually formally called a handbook for faculty and academic administrators, it lays out the processes which are rarely invoked for punishing faculty and enabling faculty to file grievances. I am committed to the tenure system. I believe the tenure system is, as the AAUP has announced, something very important for safeguarding academic freedom. I believe in free inquiry, free expression, and open dissent. Those are part of the AAUP principles. Those principles also say something we don't talk about that much, which is the importance of stability, that one of the main arguments for tenure is to provide a stable set of mentors and teachers for our students who over time can learn from by building a relationship with someone who's an expert in an area of expertise. We don't want corporations or political entities or anybody else to tell us what to do. We don't want churches to tell us what to do. The common good is not served, AAUP says, when outsiders threaten our livelihood as researchers and instructors and suppress the works of that we create or force us to modify our judgment. So tenure has a very important role in preserving some of the very things we need in order to be research-oriented teachers, scholars, clinicians, and practitioners, other practitioners. So on a very sort of mundane level, tenure also protects a livelihood. It's about keeping a job. And by the way, it isn't just fancy university professors who have tenure that protects them, but school teachers in New York get tenure. I have two nieces who are living in Connecticut and New York State, and that both of them are school teachers. They teach the fifth grade, the sixth grade. They have tenure. And I asked them, why do you have tenure? They say livelihood first, but they also say academic freedom. They too feel they need to have the ability to say things in the classroom that might not be popular, that might represent dissent from prevailing notions. So tenure isn't just reserved for fancy Ivy League professors or fancy university professors or fancy college professors. It's also something which school teachers at all levels in some states have as a protection for their jobs and their way of life. But I do think that tenure is a two-way street. And I think that at the same time that the faculty member is expected to meet their core responsibilities significantly and adequately, the school, the university, the college should try to continue their employment as long as they meet those responsibilities. So the professor is doing their job and the university is supporting them doing their job. And that's a symbiotic relationship, and ideally it works very well. But there are some exceptions to the two-way street, situations in which people are no longer able to maintain their jobs. One big category is where where financial exigencies come into play, where financial hardship makes it impossible for a university or college to continue. And people who have tenure may find themselves on the street because their university is not thriving or college is not thriving. Sometimes schools have to do away with whole departments or whole schools. And there could be, in those situations, some loss of employment. I think schools often try to reassign people when those kind of things happen, but sometimes people actually with tenure lose their jobs. But another kind of exception to this two-way street is where the faculty member may have been doing their job for the most part, but the faculty member has also violated rules or policies, done something illegal, something even criminal, something unethical that poses a serious hazard to the community or to its expressed academic and moral values. So this is it's an important relationship. It's a two-way street. Tenure is important, but there are good reasons sometimes why people with tenure face the question of whether their employment should be preserved. Trends. One trend is that tenure seems to be declining. A declining percentage of American college professors and university professors, I believe, have tenure. I think we're down to about one-third of American professors are tenure or on a tenure track. And another thing I think is worth noting is that a lot of schools do have some kind of post-tenure performance or accountability review, but most don't, but I think some do. California has something. Georgia just did something just about 3 months ago, quite stunning, which is now in the state of Georgia, there's a unique process, and by the way, this applies to Georgia Tech and the University of Georgia and Georgia State and Georgia Southern, all these state schools down there. But they now have a process run not by the faculty, but by the administrators. And that process can remove a faculty member who fails to perform in two annual post-tenure accountability reviews. So this is very controversial. I think the AAUP is up in arms about this. We'll see whether Georgia will sustain this rule. But it's a unique way, I think the state of Georgia believes, of trying to weed out what I think sometimes called dead wood, to get the faculty, to improve the faculty overall by imposing high standards of performance even after the tenure decision has been made. Okay, so ways that tenure can end. Obviously, if you have a contract, your contractual tenure ends when your contract ends. Secondly, you might choose to voluntarily separate or resign. You might want to go off and become a provost someplace or a college president, or you might want to take a job at one of our peer schools, or you might want to go back into practice of medicine full-time or practicing of law full-time or dentistry full-time. Then, of course, there's the non-voluntary types of termination where, as I mentioned before, institutional exigencies come about, financial crisis or restructuring that might cause tenure to end. But then I think the thing that's most frightening or most concerning to some faculty is that sometimes non-voluntary termination is pursued for cause where there's been some alleged wrongdoing or there's some serious performance deficiencies and issues. As was noted earlier by Professor Bram, there is a faculty handbook at Penn that lays out the process for governing sanctions that are taken against faculty members. The blue on the screen is language directly from the faculty handbook. It notes that impositions of sanctions are rare events at Penn, but they do have to take place. And when they do take place, fairness is a very important issue, and as is efficiency in the process of hearing claims and dealing with them. There are major and minor infractions that are possible, but the kinds of infractions that the Faculty Senate would get involved in would be major infractions. And these are where the university's behavioral standards have been violated. As it says here, flagrant disregard for rules, standards, or mission of the university, and then it lists some examples, which are not exhaustive, things like plagiarism, misuse of university funds, research misconduct, repeated failure to meet one's classes or to carry out assigned duties, harassment, bullying, etc. Major sanctions would include loss of the job, I say loss of tenure, but also just salary reduction, suspension, zero salary increases, and other types of specialized remedies that might apply given the nature of the misconduct which is alleged. I believe that in most cases when a faculty member at Penn is faced with the possibility of going before the Faculty Senate in one of these just cause proceedings, they choose a different route. So that we've had very, very very few full-fledged Senate just cause hearings at Penn. What other things do people do? People can you can retire, you can resign, you can move on to a different job. So there are different things people do, but not everybody who faces this decides they want to fight it, because it's a serious process, and to have your peers judge you, I think for some people is just a very unpleasant thought. The highlights of the process are simply these: that the Senate chair, I'm just like making this real simplified when you see the handbook, but basically the Senate chair forms a confidential hearing panel from among eligible faculty. And I believe that since most people on this call are members of SEC or are representatives from their schools to the faculty senate, you are among the eligible faculty who might be called upon to serve in a hearing panel. The panel investigates and they adjudicate, and they make recommendations to the administration about what should be done. And I think there's a clear and convincing evidence standard, as well as some deference, substantial deference, going to the judgment of the faculty senate. The accused faculty member can file a faculty grievance. That process is also run by the faculty senate, in the sense that the faculty senate appoints the independent grievance panel every year, and that panel can investigate and make decisions about grievances, and then refer their recommendations up to the provost's office as well. So that's the process. Okay, now for the meat. That's the background. What I'm going to say now, I want you to understand, is my opinion. I'm a philosopher as well as a lawyer. I'm giving you my opinion. My opinion comes from my experience for 7 years managing the university's promotion and tenure process. I am extremely familiar with the tenure process as it plays out at Penn, having read literally hundreds of faculty tenure and promotion dossiers. Also, I was involved in some faculty misconduct matters as an advisor and as a consultant, and in my job as a faculty affairs provost. So I feel like I have a lot of experience. What I'm going to say has been shaped by my experience. This is not the view of anybody else except Anita Allen. Okay, so what makes for a good case of termination? I love your thoughts about this response. But in my opinion, when a faculty member has violated important faculty rules and policies, has been seriously disruptive to education over a sustained period of time, has done something that's illegal or criminal or professionally unethical, or has posed a significant hazard to the community or its core values like equity, inclusion, and diversity, or when the faculty member is not significantly and adequately meeting their core responsibilities of research, teaching, or mentoring, or in some schools, clinical engagement, that's when I think we're on the path to a good case for termination. I think that seldom is one particular small thing the reason. It's often going to be a cluster of reasons. We had a Penn professor who, some of you may recall from many years ago, murdered his wife. And I think that person, that you murder your wife and go to prison, that would naturally be an invitation for the faculty senate to deprive you of your tenured position. But most cases are not obviously that simple in black and white. Now, even more difficult question, like when would I say, when if ever, may speech and conduct related to speech and speech related conduct ever warrant a sanction? Well, I think that these kinds of circumstances would give rise to a strong concern about a sanction, and maybe even prompt a sanction. So let's suppose the faculty member engages in inappropriate, unprofessional, or unethical conduct in the workplace. They're bullying people. They're using profanity in front of patients and clients and students. They're disparaging people at work based on their identities. They're insulting people. They're dishonest. They're lying. They're breaching confidentiality. They're engaging in inappropriate sexual conduct or sexual misconduct in the workplace. When these kinds of things are at issue, I think the question of sanction should be at issue. A big cluster of concerns that might warrant a sanction is where the faculty member isn't doing their job. They've become ineffective. They can't effectively teach or supervise or mentor because their students are repelled by their viewpoints. The faculty member was hired to teach, but has low course enrollments and really isn't teaching much at all. The faculty member doesn't perform their responsibilities. They're not serving on committees. They're not serving on school committees. They're not serving on department committees. They're not serving on university committees. They're not taking responsibility for any kind of projects or centers or institutes. They're not doing anything much to earn their keep. And then maybe because of all of that, the faculty member is in effect imposing unfair work burdens on their colleagues who have to pick up the slack because they're not mentoring students, they're not supervising students. Somebody has to do that, and it's falling disproportionately on other people's shoulders. And when it comes to faculty members whose speech and related conduct is offensive to minority students, it means that minority faculty often end up having to devote a significant amount of their effort, their time, to mentoring and picking up the pieces. I think that another just general way of thinking about this is that if faculty members express views and conducts and might be having a negative impact on our ability to recruit and retain faculty, recruit and retain students, recruit and retain staff, recruit and retain fellows and lab workers. So sometimes that can be a problem because people don't want to be around or be in the toxic environment created by a colleague who is doing the kinds of things that I just described. And I think that, I'm torn about this idea that about if somebody's creating a huge burden, administrative burden on a department or a school or a university, is that a reason to consider that maybe they shouldn't keep their job? I think, first of all, that none of these items on my list is intended to be a necessary or sufficient condition. These kinds of things can be grouped together to provide a reason to create the case. And it does seem to me to be relevant that somebody's conduct is causing a lot of time. But yet we know that, for example, somebody won the Nobel Prize, right, from the faculty, and that caused a lot of publicity and busyness in the dean's office and the president's office and the communication office. We'd say, bravo! We wouldn't say, that's terrible! So do we sort of hold it against someone who's exercising their free speech in a highly controversial and a manner that they may be taking up a lot of time when we would not, begrudge somebody who taking up in a lot of time because of their academic prowess or their awards or notoriety. All right, so I've given you sort of a list of things to think about, factors to consider, situations to consider where I think it's appropriate for the question of sanction to be on the table, even perhaps the ultimate sanction of loss of tenure. But I want to say that, in my view, dissent per se is rarely sufficient grounds for termination. And I have on the slide the image of Angela Davis, who's my sort of beacon for this point, because as you may recall, well, not all of you will recall, but some of us who are 69 will recall that 50 years ago, UCLA fired Angela Davis from her tenure track job as a philosophy professor for being a communist. The regents called her in, we heard you a communist, are you a communist? She said, yes, I am a member of the Communist Party, and she was fired. Well, the federal court reinstated her tenure track position, but then when she went back to UCLA, they found another pretext for firing her, which is that she was using inflammatory language. 2,000 students were showing up for her classes at a time. She was extremely popular on campus, and she was not only a communist, but also a member of several black radical movement groups. And I think all of this was just too much for poor UCLA. She did have a lot of support from her department, but the university as a whole and the regents of the University of California and Ronald Reagan were dead set upon getting rid of her one way or another. And so after she was fired the second time, she actually did not go back. But I think that dissent is important. Now, that said, I think it is possible to imagine somebody who has quote unquote dissenting views of a sort that are so disturbing that we would think about their role in our community. Someone might have extremely sadistic, bizarre, vicious, defamatory, dangerously and patently false views that we just can't easily live with. it's also important to imagine that somebody might expressing views that are considered by members of the community to be highly offensive and hurtful to our students and colleagues and staff because they're demeaning, derogatory, racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, classist, discriminatory, and as such, undercut the ability of the faculty member to perform their responsibilities, including teaching and mentorship. Those kinds of things do have an impact. You know, ideas do matter. It could, expressing certain dissenting views could have implications that do undercut one's ability to do one's job. And I think we have a responsibility as faculty to deliver our dissenting views in such a way that we preserve our ability to do our job or face the consequences, right? It's also interesting to think about this. I mean, not every dissenting view has scholarly merit, right? It could be poorly defended or you know, lacking in any kind of a plausibility. Not all dissenting views warrant repeating again and again and again and again in the same forum, right? So, you know, sure, let's hear that view, let's discuss that view, but all the time, constantly, right? And then I think there are some views which are so repellent that they actually, in a sense, shut down the marketplace of ideas because nobody wants to go to that shop in that market, as it were, yeah. So some things to think about, that dissent is rarely a sufficient grounds for termination, and yet not every dissenting view deserves to be heard in a sort of a normative sense, deserves to be heard just because it's dissenting, regardless of its consequences on the community. Something I think is very important is that we have to listen to our colleagues' own self-perceptions. And you know, we may hear our colleagues say, I'm not a racist, I'm not homophobic, I'm not prejudiced against people in wheelchairs. And yet if their behavior and their overall conduct suggest that to us as a community, I do think the community is entitled to interpret people's publications, their behavior, their appearances, et cetera, interpret them and to reach the conclusion which would differ from the conclusion the faculty member concludes about themselves. So I may not think I'm a sexist, but I may be a sexist in the eyes of others. Other people are entitled to base a judgment and act on it, even if it disagrees with my self-conception of who and what I am and what I'm like. It's very important that we not think that a single slip up by a faculty member should be cause for termination, fire them. The loss of tenure or other major sanctions, loss of salary, suspension, should be reserved for egregious cases. And I believe mostly for cases where you have ongoing problems that can be established by clear and convincing evidence as harming the policies and rules and values and mission of a community. So a person should not face loss of tenure where they've made a single racially offensive statement, especially if they've apologized sincerely, right, or offered an adequate explanation. People should not be punished for using offensive language when they're performing a work of art or teaching a work of art. You know, if you're performing Othello or Merchant of Venice or teaching those things, you don't want to be accused of being an anti-Semite because you're teaching the Merchant of Venice. You don't want to be accused of being a racist because you're teaching Othello, and you shouldn't be, right? However, there are ways to teach those seminal texts that could be actually offensive and could be a problem. There are ways to capitalize on moments like teaching such texts to sort of rub it in and to grind on people's self-esteem. So we don't want that. But I mean, I wouldn't want to say that someone, just because they're teaching a text that uses the N-word, should be sanctioned for using the N-word. And in particular, a racialist offensive statement that was made in the long time ago, you know, this is a controversial one, but if, you know, you discover a long time ago, 25, 30 years ago in that frat house, the guy put on the blackface. But since then, they've been a model member of our faculty. Do we say, you gotta have a just cause proceedings because this guy's a racist? I think that would be, to me, a surprising way to go. And I couldn't imagine that being a way that this university would want to go if that unfortunate situation had happened in Virginia were to happen here. In the university. And then this is also a tricky one. I mean, suppose that somebody makes some racist or sexist comments or such thing in their intimate life. And then it sort of comes to light, like, you know, like revenge porn. And I think that if people are in their purely private lives and someone violates their privacy rights and publicizes their inappropriate remarks or conduct, I would be loath to say that we would punish them for that. But again, for everything that I think I might say as a general rule, I could imagine some extreme case where there was a bit of an exception where we really would want to take action against somebody for something that was said in private life and publicized without their consent in violation of their privacy rights. So we're not a gotcha culture. It's not about you said the N-word, you know, off you go. We're not that kind of a place, and I'm glad we're not. And in my experience, it's extremely unusual for a member of the Penn faculty to engage in conduct over a sustained period of time that leads to repeated and widespread calls for sanctions or removal, either from persons within the Penn community or people outside of the Penn community. It's very unusual. So to the extent that we have such a situation at hand, it's very, very unusual. And none of us have much experience with how to handle it. And we're all, I think, genuinely confused about what steps should be taken in response. I've given you some of my thoughts about what kind of situations make it appropriate to act under the faculty rules to sanction somebody. But I think that, again, it's going to be very, very rough, because our faculty is, we're great. I mean, we just simply respect one another too much to too often be in situations where we're being, because of our ideas, because of our statements, from being faced with the possibility of sanction. So there are these situations, though, they're going to be rare, where termination or even itself might be worth considering. And I think that, again, it's important that we not all be so afraid, oh, that could happen to me, I might slip. But don't worry about that. Don't worry that if somebody slips up one time, they're going to be in trouble if we go after the person who's the serial problem, who's the repeated offender, so to speak. I don't think we should worry about the gotcha culture coming back to get us. And then finally, I'll just sum up by saying, I'm so interested in what you have to say and your thoughts about my perspective. But again, I think that where we are on most solid ground ethically and I think actually also legally, although I'm not offering a legal opinion here, but I think we're most on solid ground when we're dealing with conduct that's egregious, that's sustained, that where there's detrimental effects to other people, especially our students, where the job that the person was hired to do is not being adequately performed, perhaps because of their choices about speech and conduct related to speech, and where our clear rules and policies and principles are violated. So I'll stop there.
Oh, thank you very much for the presentation. And I'm going to reiterate what I said before about asking anybody who has a question or a follow-up or clarification, either put it in the chat or, as I see already happening, put their hand up. Dominic, I see you have a question. No. You're muted.
But that's just clapping, sorry.
Oh, I see. Clapping, not, yeah.
thank you, Dominic, for clapping.
One thing I could start with, just while people are formulating questions or responses, is what I, in conversations I have, the confusion people have over what free speech means generally and how that relates to the kinds of academic freedoms related to you know, professional roles as academics and speech in the classroom and so forth.
Yeah. So one source of the confusion is that a lot of people are confused about to what extent does the First Amendment and its protections apply to Penn, and as a private university, in a legal sense, we are not bound by the First Amendment. So we don't have to do what a state university would have to do by way of offering protections of free speech. However, Penn has voluntarily chosen to adopt a set of values that respect freedom of speech. So our students and our faculty and our staff are allowed to speak their mind and to speak their mind quite openly and quite freely and until they reach the point of harming others, right, or causing an imminent threat of harm to others, causing a disturbance, then I think they are going to be well supported by pain. In fact, in my experience as a vice provost, I several times had to respond to, hundreds of angry requests by people on the outside to fire a professor who said something ugly, right? But Penn's position is that we value freedom of speech. People are allowed to have their off-campus freedoms with their social media posts and so forth. People are allowed to, in the classroom, to make controversial statements. It's a question of when the freedom that we have to express our opinions, which combines, by the way, with the academic freedom we have because of the university's embrace of the AAUP principles, the two combine, the sort of the constitutionalized notion of free speech and the ideal of academic freedom combine to give professors who are articulating their academic perspectives, which may be controversial or represent dissent, gives them a space to do that without fear of losing their job, right? So those that's how they kind of come together. It's the voluntary adoption of freedom of speech along the constitutional line, and then the adoption of the AAUP principles of academic freedom and tenure, which I described earlier, which basically say that people should be able, without fear of loss of employment or pressure from the outside world, churches, corporations, the government, be able to express their learned perspectives on the topics that they are called upon to teach and research in their institution.
So, thank you. I see we have a question from Sigal Benforeth.
Hi, Sigal.
Hi, Anita. It's so good to hear your thoughts. I'm sorry that I'm on my phone, but this was really interesting. I have a question about a point that you made regarding the importance of some of the consequences of someone's speech to others or their responses to it, right? So you were saying if the speech is detrimental to others, at another point you said if it creates unfair burden on others. And so I wonder, because what some people say about that, which is not something that I necessarily endorse at all, but what some people say is, people can have all sorts of responses to all sorts of things, someone's little feelings can be hurt about this or that, maybe someone is being a prima donna and not carrying their weight in committee assignments, etc. It's not the only, we have a lot of colleagues who are not necessarily sharing all of the burdens equitably, right? So, in some instances, the response we get when we raise concerns about a colleague who is creating negative impacts on us is, tough luck, right? I mean, definitely this person may be unpleasant or their impact on you is negative, but we can't do much about that. And I wonder, when do you think it's more appropriate to say tough luck, right? I mean, is there a certain a cumulative dimension, or is there a certain line you cannot cross? Or so when is someone else's perception of us, right, and our behavior a significant enough factor in deciding whether they acted appropriately?
Well, Sigal, you are extremely wise on these topics, and I should be asking you the questions. But I think that you hit the nail on the head when you said cumulative dimension, because we all have colleagues who don't pull their weight to some extent, who say things and do things which are harmful and offensive to others. But when the burden of that kind of conduct coming from a single person begins to aggregate and to accumulate to such an extent that not only is the person interfering with our ability to do our jobs well and to enjoy the fruits of our academic labors in our departments or schools, but they themselves are struggling to do their job. because of their for example, creating student flight. Students don't want to take their classes, don't want them to be their mentors, et cetera. So I think it's sort of a quantity. Now, of course, there's no bright line, you know, do it 3 days and you're okay, do it 6 days, you know, and you're in trouble. It's not like that at all. I think it's an accumulation. I think that it takes a lot before a dean, right, would finally say, you know, hands up in the air, you're not allowed to teach anymore this class, you're not allowed to do that, you're not allowed to do that, this, I'm gonna move forward with some kind of a sanctioning process. It's just enough is enough. It takes a lot to get to that point. And so I think that, so we don't have any material reason based on Penn's experience to think that if there were a line, it's in the wrong place. Because I think that if there's any evidence at all, it's that we're extremely tolerant of dissenting opinions, of quirkiness, of offensiveness at Penn, maybe too tolerant, some of us would say. But it takes an extreme case of an accumulated effect before I think we start going into the realm of, is a sanction of some sort, some sort of discipline appropriate.
I see a question from Michael Delli Carpini. I'm going to ask him to say it out loud, if you will.
Hey, Anita, good to see you.
Hi, Michael, good to see you. I mean, I don't see you. I see your name.
Well, let me fix that.
It's okay.
I just wanted to know what you think. You know, I find your approach really convincing, but the devil's in the actual details and applications, yeah. Right? Yeah. And it does feel to me like the current socio-political climate on both the right and the left on campuses and more broadly put extra pressure, unfortunate pressure, on universities to act quickly, especially when something becomes public, and maybe not follow your basic rule of it's got to be cumulative and not to punish one-offs and so on. At least I see some evidence of that around the country. How does that factor into your thinking on this? Is it harder to do the kinds of things you've described now? And are there things we should be doing as a university to counter that?
Well, Michael, I don't see a lot of evidence that a lot of faculty are being punished for one-offs quickly. I mean, maybe if it's happening, I don't know. I know it's not happening at Penn. I don't know if it's happening nationally, but I do think you're absolutely right. There's a certain amount of pressure to act and act quickly. You know, we've seen situations recently where college presidents, university presidents, it's been announced on Monday that they had an office affair, and then on Wednesday, they're out of there, you know, right? Now, none of us know how much work went on behind the scenes before it got to that point, but it's sometimes seeming to us like people are saying, you know, you're revealed to be a racial faker, you know, a fake Native American today, you're gone tomorrow. So I think I don't think that that's a common situation. I think that there's that pressure. And I think universities are wise to resist that pressure. And I think I've been proud of Penn for resisting that pressure, for not rushing to punish faculty members who have made comments that others regard, or that even the Penn officials regard as offensive. So I agree with you on the idea that the pressure is there in the socio-political context, but I'm not sure there's much actual evidence that very many faculty members have lost positions too quickly as a result of that pressure.
Okay, fair enough. Yep. I mean, I think there are some cases, but I get the point you're making. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, and I think I should maybe spend more time reading the Chronicle. You know, since I left the vice provost role, I confess I don't read my inside education and my Chronicle every day. But so you may know more cases than I do.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I see a question hand up by Andrew Rapp. Or Rappe.
Oh, hi, everyone. I'd like to follow up with the chair offline. You mentioned that the proceedings of SCAFR are confidential and you don't know about them.
Not SCAFR, but of the hearing board.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Okay. I really enjoyed the presentation of Anita. One phrase you used, I hope you could use as a figure to amplify upon. You said consequence could come if someone harms our values. But our values are our values. Our values wouldn't change per se. Do you maybe mean from the outside it makes it look like we all aren't living up to our values? Or what do you mean? You know, what does it mean that someone acts and it harms our values? So I was interested in that.
Yeah, it's a good question. What does it mean to harm our values? I'll make up a hypothetical case. So let's say that University of Pennsylvania has committed itself in a normative, ethical, and a policy way to the goals of inclusion. And then there's a person who's disabled applying for a position, and the person comes for an interview and is insulted by a faculty member by virtue of who makes fun of the person for being in a wheelchair. To me, that's harming our values. It's, you know, we have these stated values that we should be subscribing to. They're important values. They enable us to make our faculty strong. And if the best candidate happens to be in a wheelchair and yet they're being insulted for being in a wheelchair, that's harming our values. That's what I mean. Nothing mysterious. And I think, again, one of the things I said when I first began was that please don't think that all of the standards and guidelines that might apply to situations like this are these vague, unwritten, fuzzy things. We have a lot of written documents that help to explain and clarify what our values are. Now, of course, not every faculty member at Penn subscribes to Penn's values. But one of the things you do when you take a job at a university is to, you're implicitly agreeing to honor the university, that school's values. You don't go to Brigham Young to insult Mormons, right? You don't go to Notre Dame to insult Catholics. So, you know, you don't come to Penn to insult Penn's liberal and inclusive values.
Thank you. I wanted to make one final small point that maybe could be also discussed offline. I believe that Penn's extension of academic freedom is not only to the tenured and tenure track faculty, that all instructors at Penn have academic freedom in their discipline.
I'm glad you said that, because that's absolutely true. Even if you don't have tenure, you still are entitled as a Penn faculty member to academic freedom. And the tension there, of course, is that you may have the academic freedom if you're not tenured, but it could be that if you're, say, an adjunct professor part-time, that your job security being contractual means that if people don't like what you say or like what you do, don't like your viewpoints, they can simply not renew your contract and off you go. And there's nothing that you could do about that. So there's less protection for the free speech and academic freedom of non-tenured people in theory. I think here at Penn that in practice, everybody, you know, is entitled to freedom of speech. But what comes with tenure is the extra bit of job security that people, even on the CE track, don't technically fully have.
Mm-hmm. Good. I see we have a question hand up from Dabrowski Herbert.
Yes. Hi, Anita. Lovely seeing you again and hearing you. And I do realize that we're at the hour. I just, you know, forgive my naivete, but, you know, I got this email from one of the law students that had some really specific things about this specific situation. And I realized that, you know, as you were describing, there's some clarity about what justifies a sanction limit. The email that I received, I don't know whether it's the right time to discuss it or whatever, but I did hear something, what you said about, you know, harm, you know, to the student body. And some of this email I received, it had a list of things that the students wanted, you know, description of a petition that was signed, request for there to be some transparency about this process of undergoing the sanctions. And I don't know if you can just make maybe just a few comments about, I believe other members of SEC have received similar emails from the student body about how it really felt like the comments and this kind of trend of statements they perceived as really kind of harmful to them. Maybe it's perceived or maybe it's real, but I just want to know, what can we, what can I take from this and kind of like tell the students who are up in arms, like, you know what, we're taking this very seriously. And then we're not just talking about it amongst the faculty going, oh, would this happen to me, blah, blah. But really the focus on the students and like how we're responding to them and taking this particular situation seriously. What, just give me something that I could use here, you know?
Thank you, that's extremely helpful. I've had that same exact feeling lately that I would like to know, what can I say to our students who are struggling to feel valued when professors are seem to be getting away with making statements that disparage the groups to which they belong. So what do we do? I mean, I think that my understanding is that with respect to the law school case, potential case, or situation where the dean of a law school has announced publicly an intent to pursue the possibility of sanctions. So that's a big deal for Penn. And so I think that one thing you can say to the students is that this particular problem is worrying you. Please rest assured that the university is not being passive, it's not doing nothing, they're doing something. But the process that is used is confidential, and it would take a number of months for the process to play out. So there is a process in place, it is confidential, and students, you know, they would like more transparency, you know, about what's going on. And, you know, I'm of two minds about that. I mean, to some extent, the transparency of these proceedings would be an additional burden on accused faculty members who might turn out in the end to be, you know, not discipline worthy, right? I mean, it protects the faculty that these proceedings are in confidence. On the other hand, that confidentiality also keeps the community from knowing exactly the extent to which their sense of justice is being satisfied by whatever process is in place. So I would just talk to students about the importance of process. Now they might say, well, it's been going on too long. You know, we're tired of this. I was a freshman and this was still, I'm a senior now. Well, I think that impatience is completely understandable. And believe me, as the great, great granddaughter of slaves and someone who grew up in a non-privileged first generation household, I understand impatience. You know, I saw the civil rights movement unfold in the 1960s. I attended a Jim Crow kindergarten in Alabama. So I understand that, you know, these kinds of things have gone on too long. But that said, each generation has to learn its version of patience. And this generation needs to learn its version of patience. So appreciate the processes in place that can work. And we'll see how it turns out. I hope it turns out in ways that satisfies everybody and seems fair to everybody, whatever that process, you know, might turn out to look like. But if we follow what I think the seldom used, rarely invoked faculty senate process, it's going to take a while, but I think it's a very good way for us to exercise our shared governance obligations. But I have other ideas too about what faculty can do, like talking openly about your own perspectives on the same issues that are being raised in a controversial way. You know, talk to your students. I know as a vet school professor, it may seem less like less natural to be talking about justice and you know, politics and so forth, but those things are affecting all of our students and we should have perspective. So I hope that you guys will do what I've tried to do today, and which is to say, to kind of work out my perspective. I've tried to work out my perspective and I've shared one. I know we're out of time or close to out of time, but I think that the more we all engage in reflection about how we think these matters should be addressed, and the more we share those perspectives, maybe we can come up with an approach which, when we are called upon to evaluate and judge, we have a better sense of what steps to take.
Thank you. Anita, thank you. You probably weren't reading it, but the chat is full of people thanking you for the presentation and for explaining things about this really most difficult topic. And I'll just say, you know, I said at the beginning that, you know, in my official role, I cannot comment, you know, I may not even know things, but I still, I cannot comment. But that does not mean that members of SEC themselves can't comment, can't have discussions, can't talk to students and so forth. And in fact, one of the reasons we're having these discussions, and we're having them before any potential case came up, is we think it's vital for these issues to be talked about publicly, openly, debated. That's what we do at universities. And so these things should be thought about carefully long before anybody has to do anything about them. And one very small note about the process, if these, you can read this in the handbook, I'm just quoting the handbook, if the process does proceed all the way through to an actual sanction, a major sanction, the president is required to then publish some sort of explanation and description of it. But as you said in the previous one, Anita, justice does take time, and so we have to wait for it. So again, thank you for sharing your wisdom with us. And I see it's exactly 5 o'clock, so I will thank also everybody who attended and look forward to seeing the SEC members at our next meeting. Thank you all.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye, everybody.
Recording stopped.
That went well.
It was almost exactly what you did at the subcommittee, but even more balanced out. So, yeah. Okay, thank you.
Right. Thanks. Bye.